BCY America presents Crosstalk, a nationwide call-in program discussing issues that have an effect on our families, our communities, our churches, our nation, and our world. Crosstalk, an opportunity for you to voice your concerns for biblical principles. And now live by satellite and around the world on the internet at vcyamerica.org. Here is today's Crosstalk.
And we do thank you for joining us on Crosstalk today here on VCY America. I believe you'll find this to be a very unique interview today. You see, no other figure has impacted history like Jesus. Yet today he's often seen as a mythical character whose legend increased over time. So what does the historical and archaeological evidence say about Jesus? Well, our guest today has investigated firsthand the discoveries connected to Jesus' birth, his ministry, his crucifixion, his burial, and his resurrection. He has visited and excavated where Jesus walked and examined the artifacts connected to Jesus' life and presents an up-to-date and comprehensive overview of the research and finding that illuminates the historicity of Christ as presented by the Bible. Joining us today, we welcome Dr. Titus Kennedy. He is a professional field archaeologist currently directing projects in Bible lands while researching, writing, and teaching in the field of biblical archaeology. He's a research fellow at Discovery Institute. He's been a consultant, a writer, a guide for history and archaeology documentaries and curricula. He has authored the book Unearthing the Bible and now his latest book, Excavating the Evidence for Jesus. Dr. Titus, thank you for joining us here today on Crosstalk.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Tell me what first drew your interest to the field of archaeology.
Well, back in elementary school, I liked history. It was one of my favorite subjects. And in fourth grade, my teacher gave me a book on the excavation of Troy. And that was really my introduction into archaeology and understanding that some of the historical information that we got, even much of it, comes from excavations and surveys through archaeology and not just from historical manuscripts being passed down. So I was intrigued by that, how we could go out and uncover and discover new things. And eventually I decided that I wanted to try to study archaeology and see if that was a viable career for me.
Your latest book is Excavating the Evidence for Jesus, and if you could just give us an overview, why is Jesus so under attack today? I mean, we can go back to other figures in history, but none are under attack like we see Jesus.
Well, from my perspective, the existence or historicity of Jesus in the Gospels is under attack so much because Jesus is the central figure of the Bible and of Christianity. And let's face it, in our culture today, Christianity is not as widespread or as popular as it once was. In many other countries, you know, you have different scenarios. People may not even be thinking about Jesus or Christianity that much. But certainly in the United States, there can be a lot of hostility or at least skepticism towards the Bible and towards Jesus.
You know, a point you make in your book that I found rather interesting is that even though the existence of Jesus is under attack, you look at our world's calendar system and it's based on his existence.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really interesting that his existence is under attack, or that you read newspaper articles or documentaries and maybe even in high school classes, things like that. People may claim there's no evidence outside the Bible that Jesus existed. So that's something that gets repeated and spread around a lot, although, oddly enough, that is not the position of professional scholars in the field of archaeology or ancient history.
We're talking with Dr. Titus Kennedy here today, and you indicate in your book that Jesus became the most famous, the most influential person in all of human history. Yet, when we go to the pages of Scripture, like in Luke 9:58, we see foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man hath not where to lay his head. Isn't that rather ironic?
It is. But that was just the plan in history.
Dr. Titus, your book takes us chronologically through the Gospels, dealing first with the birth of Christ, of Bethlehem, the Magi. Whether it be found statues or coinage or historical writings, there really were people like Caesar Augustus and Herod the Great. Take us back to that time, if you would.
So, st- starting with the early chapters of the Gospels and the birth narrative of Luke, we get several figures that are recounted or recorded in Gospels such as Luke and Matthew. Luke talks about Caesar Augustus. He talks about Quirinius, Herod. We hear Herod talked about in the Gospel of Matthew and Archelaus. And then as you go a little bit later into the Gospel of Luke, you see many of the other leaders listed as well. And all of these high-profile political leaders are attested in ancient documents, in coinage, in statues, and inscriptions. And so there's really no question as to their existence, their position, and their place in time.
Mm-hmm. And again, there are things like coinage and so forth that has actually borne that out.
Yes, absolutely. Coinage that some of these rulers minted themselves, inscriptions that they commissioned, talking about perhaps some events during their rule, or in the case of Augustus, there's a biography of his life like that. And then, of course, the Caesars have statues of themselves made.
Tell us about Nazareth. I mean, quite a small place, but it really did exist. I mean, this is where the angel Gabriel made the announcement to Mary that she would give birth to the Messiah. Some pretty interesting findings pertaining to Nazareth.
Yeah, Nazareth was one that actually came under attack as being an unhistorical location in the Gospels. Not that they were saying Nazareth never existed, but some scholars were arguing that Nazareth didn't exist or wasn't occupied in the first century at the time of Jesus. But archaeology has then turned up material from the first century that demonstrated Nazareth. It was indeed a town in the first century. There were Jews who lived there who observed the Mosaic law. And so we get the same kind of picture of Nazareth in the archaeology as we see from the Gospels.
Mm-hmm. Not very large, though, was it at the time?
No, it was quite a small village, and probably based around agriculture and construction.
Is there evidence of a census that took Joseph and Mary to Bethlehem?
There is. This is one of the most debated things in the Gospels as far as the accuracy of Luke on the census, but I believe that it's correct, and we have archaeological and historical evidence that corroborates this. So we could go back to the records of Augustus himself, and he says that he issued 3 empire-wide censuses during his reign. One of those was begun in 8 BC. So if Herod died in 4 BC, about March of 4 BC, then this census associated with Jesus' birth would have to be before that. So the 8 BC one is the closest one, and it may have taken some time to get to Judea, but it was indeed an empire-wide census. Then Luke tells us that Quirinius was the one who was a ruler in Syria at the time, and he's responsible for administering the census in the Judea region. So Judea was attached to Syria province because Judea was a client kingdom at that time. It wasn't its own province. Herod was the local ruler.
Mm-hmm.
When we know about Quirinius, he was actually a very famous Roman commander of legions, and also at times was governor of a province. And he's placed in that region around this time. There's actually an inscription that was found in Beirut. So at the time, that was part of Syria province. And it talks about a census that Augustus had ordered, and Quirinius was the local military ruler, and he was the one in charge of it in that region. We've got some other materials that connect to that, but it really does seem like Luke got that right. He named the right people and the right time.
What about the actual birthplace of Jesus? And we know Micah had foretold it would be in Bethlehem, but as to the actual site within Bethlehem, we know that there's a church in the Nativity, but is there evidence that this is the actual site?
I think that we could have some confidence that it's probably the actual site, and you might ask why that is. I would say 3 major reasons for that. The first is that there is basically a continuous Christian presence in the area from the time of Jesus' ministry until the churches were built under the order of Constantine in the 4th century. But in addition to that, we have materials, writings from the second and third century that mention Jesus being born in a specific cave in the village of Bethlehem. And then early in the second century, during the time of Hadrian, probably around 130, 135, he had a number of temples and shrines to various Roman deities that were built over sites connected to events in the life of Jesus, and one of those was the birthplace. And this was basically part of a campaign of propaganda or to erase the history associated with Jesus. And one of the shrines he had built was right over that cave, which is now at the back of the Church of the Nativity.
Wow, very interesting. Folks, you're listening to Dr. Titus Kennedy, who's put out a book entitled Excavating the Evidence for Jesus. There is a lot of debate, and it happens every year at Christmas time, Dr. Kennedy, as it relates to the date of December 25th for the birth of Jesus. And you address this issue in your book and have comments that others have not brought forth. Would you comment on the date of December 25th? Some believe it should be springtime, or some have talked about the fall. But you've got some interesting things here regarding December 25th.
I think that we have some good reasons to say that December 25th is a possibility and the favored possibility. If we know the date for Jesus' birth, it's more likely that it's that one than one of these others. And why do I say that is because it really goes back into very early Christian history that December 25th was regarded as the birthday of Jesus, or also, we have the 25th of March was regarded as the conception date of Jesus, the 9 months prior to December 25th. And we're going back to the second century with this. And Christians weren't making the same kind of big celebration about it as happens today.
Mm-hmm.
But they still talked about it in some of their writings. And, you know, some of this idea about how, it was just later emperors who were trying to put a Christian holiday over a pagan one or something. Actually, it's more the reverse, that the Romans saw the growth of Christianity and that it was threatening them. And so they created some holidays or one holiday, the Sol Invictus birth, to try to paganize that. And again, a similar method to Hadrian in trying to confuse people or syncretize Roman religion with Christianity.
Is there evidence for the Magi? I mean, Scripture speaks of them offering gifts. Is there evidence that comes forth on that?
There's not evidence of those specific Magi so much as the class of people, the Magi. We know about them, and the way that they are depicted in Matthew is historically plausible.
Mm-hmm.
There is a second century text called the Revelation of the Magi that talks about the visit of the Magi to Jesus, but we couldn't necessarily say that's a 100% accurate historical text, but there's nothing historically inconsistent about how they're portrayed in Matthew.
Dr. Titus Kennedy, our guest here today on Crosstalk, author of the newly released Excavating the Evidence for Jesus. Folks, it's a very fascinating book. We'll have more discussion on it following the break. You're listening to Crosstalk.
Back to Genesis with Dr. John Morris, popular creation speaker with the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Morris, have investigators found any evidence of life in outer space?
Not a bit, Chris. They've pointed their telescopes to the skies, hoping to pick up any signal that's non-random, like Morse code. Actually, they're setting their sights rather low. They think that just a few letters would indicate intelligent life. But at the same time, scientists look at the incredibly complex information-loaded DNA code with billions of letters all in a precise sequence and call it random. In spite of this incredible complexity, atheistic scientists refuse to believe that it's the evidence of intelligence. Yet they say that the simple hoped-for code from outer space would be the sign of intelligent life. How inconsistent! At least the creation model doesn't depend on claims such as this. Let's go back to Genesis and get it right.
For more on creation, visit our website at www.icr.org.
are listening to Crosstalk on VCY America, and our topic today, excavating the evidence for Jesus. And friends, we are only going to scratch the surface as to the information that's contained in this newly released book. It is nearly 300 pages long. And this came out here from the publisher. The retail is for $24.99. However, through March 31st, our VCY bookstore has worked with the publisher, and they want to get this into your hands. And they are offering this book at 52% off through March 31st. And the clock is ticking on that. I should say the calendar pages are turning just for the next several days. Through March 31st, 2022, at 52% off, they're offering it for just $11.99 plus any applicable tax and or shipping. It's a featured book of the month at the bookstore. It's available at vcy.com, vcy.com, or by calling during business hours at 1-888-722-4829. That's 1-888-722-4829. But it's a book certainly that takes us chronologically through the life of Christ, and beginning with certainly the incarnation and so forth, and takes us through the death, the burial, the resurrection of our Savior. And we're going to be discussing more information here today with our guest. But again, it's available right now, vcy.com, or by calling 1-888-722-4829. Dr. Kennedy, as we take a look as after the birth of Jesus, we know after the Magi left as well that Joseph was warned in a dream to take Mary and to flee to Egypt with Jesus. Do we know where in Egypt that they went?
We couldn't say specifically where in Egypt that they went. There are a number of traditional sites, really going back into antiquity, but there's no agreement and no really early source. So we have some ancient churches there, including one in Cairo that is quite old. But, again, no documents that specifically point to any one area.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was a horrible period in our world's history known as the Slaughter of the Innocents. And many are familiar with the ancient historian Josephus, and he did not write about the killing of these young children by Herod. And so some have concluded then, because Josephus didn't write about this, that it really did not happen. How do you respond to that?
Well, Josephus didn't write about a lot of things, so we can't necessarily use this argument from silence to say that something didn't happen. Josephus was concerned with the major political figures of the day. So he wouldn't necessarily be talking about the death of some babies of peasants in a very small village. And Bethlehem was very, very small, so the amount of children that were killed was going to be relatively small, say 10 to 20. However, we do have some other records that connect to this massacre of the innocents. For example, Josephus does give us information about Herod and how Herod even killed three of his own sons, and he got more and more paranoid near the end of his life, which is also the time when Jesus was born. So it fits with the profile of Herod. But then we have this interesting text that is called the Assumption of Moses. It seems to be from the first century. And it talks about Herod as a killer of babies. And it compares him to the Pharaoh who ordered the Hebrew children to be killed prior to the Exodus. And then we have another source called Saturnalia that comes from about 400 AD that says, "I would rather be Herod's pig than his son." And so he knows about the killing of young children by Herod.
Interesting. You've got a picture, and one of the features of the book is some full-color pictures of various pieces of archaeological evidence and so forth. But you've got a picture on page 86 of your book of something called the Pilate Stone. What is the Pilate Stone?
The Pilate Stone was a Latin inscription, a monumental inscription that was commissioned by Pontius Pilate, the governor of Judea, while he was there. And it was found in Caesarea, or Caesarea, which was the Roman capital of the province on the coast of the Mediterranean. And on this stone, it gives us Pilate's name, Pontius Pilatus, and his title, prefect of Judea, governor of Judea. And it's some kind of dedication to a building for Emperor Tiberius. So when this was discovered, it was the first artifact or inscriptional evidence from the first century that confirmed the existence of Pontius Pilate and his position as governor of Judea.
Interesting. And there's also been evidence uncovered regarding Pilate and his character, too.
Yes, Josephus wrote fairly extensively about him. Also, we have information about Pilate in the writings of Philo of Alexandria, and then Tacitus, for example, also mentions his role in the crucifixion, the trial and crucifixion of Jesus. And then we have coins that were issued by Pilate during his reign, and quite recently, a ring bearing the name of Pilate was also discovered at Herodium.
Jumping ahead here to page 107 of your book, you've got a photo of the ruins of the house of Peter at Capernaum. But could you tell us about that? How do we know this was Peter's house?
Well, I would say that we can be fairly certain that it was Peter's house. I don't know if I could say 100%, but why? Good question. So when this was excavated and researched, they found that this had been a house or a residential building that was originally constructed probably around the first century BC, and it was part of the town of Capernaum. It's also located very, very close to the synagogue in Capernaum, which if you read the Gospels, you understand that the house of Peter was right by the synagogue, and they went from the synagogue and then immediately to the house of Peter. But then, over time, this house was changed. Like around the middle of the first century, it stopped being used as a regular house. It was more of a meeting point, it seems, communal meeting place, and then they plastered the walls, and all of these inscriptions start popping up on the wall starting in the second century that talk about Jesus, and some of them even mention Peter. And then we have some early accounts of pilgrims who went to visit the Holy Land, and they mentioned the house of Peter there. And so after time, a quote-unquote official church got built there, even though it was already functioning as a house church. And so the tradition is very, very strong going back to the first century, and everything that we know about it fits it being the house of Peter.
Wow, very interesting. And time does not avail us to go extensively through your book here, but what do you believe, Dr. Kennedy, are some of the most significant finds pertaining to Jesus' earthly ministry prior to his crucifixion, burial, and resurrection?
I would say that some of the locations connected with some of his miracles are highly significant, and I would include in those things like the Pool of Bethesda and the Pool of Siloam. Now, not that the locations themselves prove that events happened, but they help us to understand the context better and the historical plausibility. But then you get into this question of the miracles and some other things that have been discovered or passed down over time are ancient historical texts that discuss the nature of the miracles of Jesus. And we have preserved in the writings of a variety of different people from different viewpoints that all affirm their belief, anyhow, that Jesus performed miracles. They simply attribute the source of the miracle to a different thing or person depending on their worldview. For example, you have Celsus, who was a pagan, an opponent of Christianity, and he claimed that Jesus performed miracles because he learned the magic of the Egyptians. And then you have, in the Mishnah, the miracles of Jesus were attributed to the power of Satan, like we see the Pharisees claiming in the Gospels. Then you have Christian sources that just say, look, it happened. You can look at your own Roman records of Pontius Pilate. So no one was really denying it. They just had different explanations for how it occurred.
Interesting. Tomb of Lazarus is said to have been found?
Yes. So this is another one of these early Byzantine sites, or one that was marked more clearly, at least, around the 4th century. But it is a 1st century tomb in Bethany, and it apparently had a very, very ancient tradition going back to the beginning of the church. So, again, this is one of those sites where we could say that may have been the tomb of Lazarus. I can't tell you for 100% certainty, but it's a good possibility.
Yeah, and friends, as you obtain the book, you'll find his writing on this, as well as a photograph of the interior of that first century tomb of Lazarus in Bethany. Chapter 7 of your book, you start dealing with the trial and the crucifixion of Jesus. Is there evidence as to the location of the trial itself?
So the narrative of the trial of Jesus is quite incredible in terms of the amount of archaeological connection and corroboration, because we know the location of every place except for maybe the house of Annas. We have multiple attestations of all the different figures involved in that trial from the first century. And we know that the way in which they conducted the trial and then the crucifixion and the burial is consistent with what we found from archaeology and history during that period. So it's corroborated beyond anything that we should be able to expect from the first century in a trial of someone who was just basically a regular citizen or a peasant at the time.
Yeah, I mean, and you've got evidence in your book, too, even evidence that has been found of Roman crucifixions during that time period.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way that the New Testament talks about the crucifixion of Jesus, you know, says that they put nails through his hands or his wrists and his feet. And in what was the first discovery of a first century crucifixion victim in Jerusalem, they found one of the nails still lodged in the heel bone of the victim. And then in a more recent one, they found a nail lodged in the wrist of the victim. And so we know that that's how they were doing it. And although there may have been some different techniques used for crucifixion various times and places, you know, people have talked about sometimes they may have used ropes to tie them up there. But we know that the evidence shows the way the New Testament depicts crucifixion, that is how it happened.
Friends, we're going to take a quick break here, and we're going to take a portion of the next segment also just talking about the crucifixion and resurrection as well. I just wanted to remind you, though, the book that's available, Excavating the Evidence for Jesus, is available through the VCY Bookstore as one of their featured books of the month. They have it at 52% off, just $11.99, plus any applicable tax or shipping. It's available at vcy.com. VCY.com or calling 1-888-722-4829. We'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to Crosstalk.
The Bible says that life is but a vapor that's here for a short time and then vanishes away. Scripture also says it's appointed unto man once to die, but after this, the judgment. Have you ever wondered what happens when you die? In the book, What Happens After Life, author Ron Rose provides a survey of the Bible's teachings about the afterlife. He tracks the destiny for those who know Christ as Savior and the destiny for unbelievers. He addresses numerous topics, such as the immediate state after death, believers and the judgment seat of Christ, unbelievers and the great white throne judgment, the new heavens and the new earth, the new Jerusalem, and so much more. He even tackles the question of what happens to infants, young children, and those mentally disabled as it relates to eternity. What Happens After Life is available for a donation of $15 or more by calling VCY at 1-800-729-9829. 1-800-729-9829.
Today in Crosstalk, we're examining the evidence surrounding Jesus, and our guest here today, Dr. Titus Kennedy, has recently released a book on the archaeology and history of Christ in the Gospels. It's entitled Excavating the Evidence for Jesus. And kind of working our way through the book, but friends, we are literally scratching the surface of the book there. It is filled just approximately 300 pages of information here, and historical evidence, archaeological evidence, all pertaining to the life of Christ, from his birth all the way through his death, burial, resurrection, and then ascension. We were talking about the time of the trials of Jesus, and the locations you mentioned were found, really, of the historical figures. They're all part of this, but you've got some further comments regarding the actual trial of Jesus itself.
So the trial begins with Annas, and Jesus goes to the house of Annas, and it says he appears before this high priest. Some people are confused as to why Luke, for example, in Luke 3:1 says that Annas and Caiaphas were high priests when there's only supposed to be one high priest. If we look at Roman records of the time, Josephus, for example, makes it clear that the Romans were appointing and deposing high priests. And so that's why there could be one year and then the next year a different guy who was still alive and well. But in the minds of those who are following the Mosaic law, this was supposed to be a position that was held for life. So that's why they still regarded Annas as a high priest from the perspective of Judaism. But anyhow, Annas is also mentioned in the writings of Josephus, and it seems that his tomb was found outside of Jerusalem. It's probably the most elegant and intricately carved and decorated tomb of the first century around Jerusalem, and it's right where Josephus places it. As far as where his house is located, we couldn't say with exact certainty. There are probably three good candidates of priestly houses that have been excavated from first century Jerusalem. In fact, one that's sometimes called the Burnt House actually has an inscription in it linking it to a high priestly family, so that could have been it. But then we move on to Caiaphas, and Caiaphas is attested, of course, also in Josephus, but his ossuary, his burial box, was actually discovered in the family tomb of the Caiaphas family, and it's an incredibly intricate burial box. And another ossuary was discovered recently, which is of his granddaughter and connects the family to the priestly line of Maaziah, which is mentioned in the Book of Chronicles. So we have an inscription mentioning Caiaphas, the high priest. And then we move to Pilate. Now, we talked about the Pilate stone and the ring and so forth, but the praetorium, we also know where this was located, and part of it has been excavated. It's on the western side of Jerusalem. It was in the former site of the palace of Herod, and there are even some remnants of this, the Gabbatha, the raised place area, and the stone pavement that John speaks of, where this bema would have been and where Pilate and Jesus would have been visible for the people who are listening in on the trial. And then finally, we look at Jesus and what kind of attestation do we have of him. And we've got several first and second century historical writings outside of the Bible that mention Jesus, including his trial. But there's also this somewhat controversial inscription on the James ossuary that says, James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. Now, after all of the analysis, and it was even involved in an antiquities trial, it was demonstrated that the entire inscription was ancient. None of it was added later. And it's the right kind of stone for the Jerusalem area in the first century. So this seems to be an inscription that's mentioning Jesus. You know, it mentions the brother because Jesus was so famous, well-known, and important. So we've got there all the locations. We've got the major figures involved in the trial of Jesus. We have Roman sources mentioning the trial of Jesus. And everything's consistent with what we know about those processes historically.
Wow, it's amazing. Do we know, Dr. Kennedy, the location of Golgotha? I know there's some debate on that.
We could say a possibility of the location of Golgotha, or a likely possibility. I think the tomb is extremely solid in its location, but there is a rock hill, a remnant of a rock hill, that's very close to the tomb that also has an extremely ancient tradition, and it would fit, although it seems like the tomb location was much more thought about and remembered by the early Christians, mm-hmm. more so than the specific crucifixion location.
Yeah. Can we be certain of the date, A.D. 33, for the crucifixion of Jesus?
I believe so, yes. And you know, this involves a lot of different chronological things, but maybe the easiest way to explain it is that the 15th year of Tiberius is when Luke says Jesus began his ministry. And so this was in about 28 A.D. And so 30 A.D. is basically ruled out due to a minimum of three Passovers being mentioned in the book of John during Jesus' ministry. I think there may be mention of actually five. But then we see astronomically that Nisan 14 only falls on a Friday. In 30 or 33 A.D. So if it's not 30, you know, our next, we have to bump it up to 33 A.D., and that really allows the time that we have in the Gospels. And this has become fairly well accepted throughout scholarship as the date. Harold Honer did a major work on the chronology of Christ, and this is what most use today.
Yeah, and skeptics, I mean, there are those who say Jesus really did not die. He was rather just unconscious and then regained consciousness. The evidence is quite to the contrary, though, isn't it?
Yes, definitely, because the Roman sources even say that he died, that he was crucified under Pontius Pilate. And you did not recover from Roman crucifixion, even in the case where you were... Someone swooped in to try to save you. Many even died. For example, you look at the way that they went about doing crucifixion. They started by beating the victim or the offender, and that person could have died even from the beatings. Maybe not immediately right there, but soon after. And then they are nailed to a cross, and they're in a position where they're having extreme blood loss and trauma, and it's very, very much difficulty breathing. The best of them it could survive for quite a while, but then you see how they tried to end things faster. They'd break the legs so that the people wouldn't be able to hold themselves up to breathe. And then in the case of Jesus, we're told about they spear him, and they checked, and he had already been dead. That's why you had this separation of, we call it, John talks about the blood and water separating. And it was very well accepted that he was dead. And I would say there's a really important Roman inscription that attests to this. It's called the Nazareth inscription. It's essentially a letter or a rescript of Claudius. And it talks about how there's now a death penalty for anybody who goes to a stone-sealed sepulcher tomb and steals a body with wicked intent. And so they knew about the stories of the resurrection, but they knew that Jesus was dead, of course, and they were trying to say that the disciples stole the dead body.
Hmm. Very interesting. And, I mean, just even the customs and everything, we had Roman soldiers guarding the tomb at that time, for Jesus to have resurrected, what a glorious miracle.
Definitely. Yeah, something that no one had ever seen before, and that's why they were trying to spread the story that the disciples had stolen the body of Jesus, and yet they never found it.
Yeah, yeah. He is not here. He has risen, as he said, the angels proclaimed. Friends, again, this book, Excavating the Evidence for Jesus, really walks you through from the birth of Christ all the way through the burial, tomb, and resurrection of Jesus. And it's available through the VCY bookstore. It's being featured as a book of the month, normally $24.99. Just came out from the publisher They're offering this to get it into your hands, 52% off, $11.99 plus any applicable tax or shipping. You can go online at vcy.com, vcy.com, or calling 1-888-722-4829. If you perhaps have a question you'd like to ask our guest here today on Crosstalk, our call-in number is 800-733-9829, 800-733-9829. Dr. Kennedy, what impact did writing this book altogether, this volume altogether from birth to resurrection, what impact did that have on you?
For me personally, it really helped me to understand some of the historical and chronological issues better and to organize everything in my mind. And it brought me up to date on a few very recent discoveries or reevaluations. And so it was really helpful in my own personal study and understanding. And then that transfers into teaching and, of course, writing.
Yeah. The book is one, too, that really will answer a lot of the questions of the skeptics, will it not?
I believe so, especially what we had talked about at the beginning of the show in regard to these claims that there's no evidence outside of the Bible from ancient times that Jesus existed. So in the back of the book, I actually put quotations of all of these first and second century writers that are attesting to the existence of Jesus and to specific events in his life.
And that's rather remarkable. And there's multiple first and second century historians and philosophers that mention Jesus Christ. And he has it outlined in the back of the book here, as well as a timeline as well through the life of, through these who the life of Christ, events happening during that time, and certainly the rise to power of people like Herod the Great and others, and you'll find that all documented in the book. Let's go to the phone lines here today on Crosstalk. We begin with Joseph in Sussex, Wisconsin. You're on the air.
Thank you, Doctor, for your good work. And, Jim, if I may have two questions, the first being the archaeological accuracy, the look and feel, and the overall accuracy of the movie called The Passion of the Christ.
Okay, and your second question?
The second question is our beloved friend, Dr. Jimmy DeYoung Sr., has proposed that there was some kind of a bridge that went from the temple out to the Mount of Olives, and has suggested that that might be the place of the crucifixion.
Okay. Thank you, Joseph. First of all, any comment here on the Passion of the Christ?
I think that they did a very good job
That.
They used some great consultants, and I think that gives us a really good picture of what that whole Passion would have looked like.
Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you what, we're going to answer the second question right after the break because the music has started here. Dr. Titus Kennedy with us here today on Crosstalk. We'll be back in just 1 minute. This is Crosstalk on the VCY American Network. Today we're discussing the book, Excavating the Evidence for Jesus. We'll be right back.
For the Worldview Report, I'm Brandon House. Our website is worldviewreport.com. Did you guys know about BioLogos? This is an organization I warned about in my 2016 book, The Coming Religious Reich. Reich means empire or kingdom. How ironic that I warned about BioLogos, because that is an organization that was catering specifically to pastors to teach theistic evolution, which is that God used evolution. That undermines the Bible. It undermines the authority of the Bible. It also brings us death and disease before the original sin and the fall. How could God proclaim everything good as he did, very good, when there's all this death that's been going on for millions and millions of years? You see, theistic evolution undermines the Bible. Who's promoting that? Francis Collins. Remember him with the NIH, who is reportedly harvesting baby scalps to put on the back of rodents? That's the guy that started BioLogos to infiltrate the churches of America. Be warned.
hour is far too short to cover all this material here today, but just kind of unpacking it and giving you the tools and resources here to do further digging in his book, Excavating the Evidence for Jesus. Dr. Titus Kennedy is our guest here today, a professional field archaeologist, and he is directing projects right now in Bible lands. He's done researching, writing, teaching in this field of biblical archaeology. So, Dr. Kennedy, the second question had to do with this the crucifixion site, perhaps the bridge that the caller referred to here.
Yes, so the question was about the possibility of the Mount of Olives being the crucifixion site. And I would say that the Mount of Olives is named specifically in the Gospels whenever there are events that occur there. So that would be one question I would bring to mind. But we also have the crucifixion site quite close to the tomb site, and it's along this major road. And that really fits with what we know about the area near the church of the Holy Sepulchre, or the tomb of Jesus. So I would lean towards putting the crucifixion site somewhere close to the tomb of Jesus on that side of Jerusalem.
Let's go to Sean calling in from Milwaukee. Hi, Sean. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. Just curious, has the validity of the Shroud of Turin ever been determined?
Oh, good question. And you address this in your book, Dr. Kennedy.
There have been many, many researchers from different backgrounds who have worked on this, and you know, there's a huge amount of articles online and some books, so I would encourage you to go look at those. I think they have some really compelling arguments for the Shroud of Turin being a first-century burial shroud. That, indeed, does seem to fit. Whether or not we can definitively link that to Jesus, I don't know if we could say that for sure. Possibility. There's still no explanation as to how that image got on the shroud. You know, we don't know how to reproduce that. So it's a really curious artifact. I do think it's a first century burial shroud from that area, at least. So it's an open question somewhat.
Hmm. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
Let's go to Sally in Ainsworth, Nebraska. You're on the air, Sally.
Hi, thank you for Crosstalk, and my thanks to Dr. Kennedy for all his work. I have a friend that is curious if he has located the site of the upper room and what may have been built on top of it or found under it.
Okay. Thank you, Sally. What about the upper room? Has evidence found where this is?
We have a good idea, probable location of the upper room. So you can actually go visit that site today. And it's a church, or the remains of what was a church, that is located above ground now. But if we went down to the first century remains, there have been some archaeological investigations done there. And they found that there was indeed this building, a fairly large building there. But it also has a tradition going back to the early church with some artwork connecting it to what was later called the Church of the Apostles on Mount Zion. And that is a church that was built because of the location of the upper room and because the church had been meeting in that upper room for a long period of time. So I would say I think we can know where the location is. The building itself, we're not able to see those remains today.
Okay, good question. Thank you for the call. Olney, Illinois. George, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was going to ask your author, because Jesus is the Lamb of God and also known as the Lion of Judah, Capricorn, which is December 25th, and Libra, which is basically during the fall festivals, one is the lion and the other one is the goat. Abraham spoke of the ram being caught in the thicket, and he sacrificed him instead of his son Isaac. Is there any possibility that he was born twice?
No, I don't think that astrology has anything to do with the chronology of Christ.
Yeah, yeah. Amen. Thank you. Let's go to John in Dallas, Texas. John, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to ask, how does time, like
I mean, I've been all through Jerusalem and Israel, but how does time, is that just in areas like Jerusalem? Do they just bring dirt in and pile it over old? Why is everything down so far?
Okay, buried, yeah. Thank you, John, for that. And we're down to just 2 minutes here. Go ahead, Dr. Kennedy.
So in places like Jerusalem, where people are constantly living over the centuries, they're constantly rebuilding things. I mean, Jerusalem has been destroyed many times also. And so they build, and then they build on top of what the foundations that they built on, and then they continue doing that. And that's how things are getting buried over time. Yes, in some cases, in the past, in ancient times even, they moved large amounts of dirt to fill in the foundations of old buildings and flatten out an area. So that happened. It was intentional. It wasn't that just, you know, dirt and dust was falling and collecting over time.
Dr. Kennedy, what impact would you like this book to have on the reader? What's your heart's prayer?
I really hope that people are able to not just see the evidence, but remember it, recall it, so that they know the reasons that we have for the existence of Jesus and the reliability of the Gospels, and they're able to answer questions that other people have about that, and they're able to respond to criticisms of the Gospels and the life of Jesus.
It's really a book of apologetics, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I also think secondarily that it can help in our historical context study of the Gospels, but there is just so much pushback against the reliability of the Bible and the Gospels today that that's really one of the main objectives.
Well, friends, it's called the Excavating the Evidence for Jesus. It's the Archaeology and History of Christ and the Gospels. Again, it's being featured as a book of the month at the VCY bookstore. They have it 52% off. It's available online at vcy.com, vcy.com. Or you may reach them during business hours at 1-888-722-4829. If you get a busy signal, just give them a call back. This is a good through March 31st, 2022. That's 1-888-722-4829. Well, Dr. Kennedy, I know this took a long period of time for you to put this information together, but it is very well worth it, and we thank you so much for your efforts in doing so and also joining us here on the program.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Dr. Titus Kennedy, our guest here today on Crosstalk. And friends, check it out and share the truth with others. God bless you, folks. Thanks for joining us today on Crosstalk.
You've been listening to Crosstalk via satellite and the Internet from VCY America. Views expressed may or may not be those of this station. For a CD of today's program, send a donation of $6 or more to VCY Tape Ministry, 3434 West Kilbourne Avenue, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 53208. Or download by RSS or podcast from crosstalkamerica.com. And join us again for Crosstalk.